23 tonight. Looks like rain and wind tomorrow with a high of 40. It's 25 in Kenosha, 23 in Racine at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.
On several different occasions, I have had the great pleasure of speaking with an outstanding writer, Tom Clavin. He has been a distinguished reporter for the New York Times for many, many years and the author of a whole host of books. I spoke with him first, I believe, about his fascinating account of the chaotic final hours of American troops in Saigon, in his book Last Men Out. Most recently, I spoke with Tom Clavin about his book called Dodge City. And now we, in a sense, return to that same larger canvas to hear the story of one of the most colorful figures from the Old West, Wild Bill. The book is titled Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. And Wild Bill Hickok is one of those figures who looms large in American history and yet is not all that well understood. And so Tom Clavin has done a remarkable job of separating fact from fiction and paints for us a very vivid portrait indeed. And I'm excited to have a few minutes to speak with Mr. Clavin about his marvelous new book, which is published by St. Martin's Press, again titled Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
This is great, great fun, and I really enjoyed the book thoroughly. Let's talk for a moment about that whole matter of separating fact from fiction, from fable, whatever you want to call it. And maybe it would be good for us to first understand just how much legend sprung up around the figure of Wild Bill Hickok and how soon in his life that occurred.
It occurred early on in his life. He was still a young man, and he became, you could possibly give this accolade, so to speak, to George Custer, too. But in the post-Civil War American frontier, Wild Bill Hickok became really the first celebrity, is the best way to put it, because he did have some genuine exploits that had begun before the Civil War. He had some adventures during the Civil War, especially as a Union spy. And after the Civil War, he had engaged in what was considered the first recorded gunfight, where two men squared off against each other, and the first one drew fastest and shot the straightest. And that was Hickok. And he had other adventures on the Great Plains as a scout for the Union Army and fighting Indians and things like that. But a magazine called Harper's New Monthly, which was very popular, especially to readers back east, did a profile of Bill Hickok. And it really catapulted him into the celebrity range, because even though some of the stories that it related, the reporter related, were either not true or, let's say, maybe embellished or exaggerated. There were some very true stories in there about some of his true adventures, and the combination of the two made Hickok seem like this almost mythical American frontier figure. And he became very famous almost overnight, and he stayed that way to the end of his days. And some of his subsequent adventures were true and were reported on, but his celebrity status took on a life of its own. They started to write these dime store novels about him and stories about him, and there were several newspaper reports that had him dying in Dodge City or in Cheyenne or in a gunfight or someplace else that kept popping up. And Hickok, when he could, would write a letter to the editor of the newspaper. He liked writing letters, and say, "No, I'm not dead. I'm fine. I'm still here." So he became a celebrity. And the more sometimes the more outrageous stories that were told about him, you know, killing 10 men at one time, were the better, because people just were ready to believe that this was some kind of Western superhero.
Right. If someone wants an example of so-called fake news, there's probably no better place to look than some of the publications during Wild Bill Hickok's life.
It's true. You know, things would pop up, and you know, suddenly they'd spread like a prairie fire. You know, I mentioned again that there was one report of him being shot to death in Dodge City, and that was suddenly all over the frontier. Oh, poor Wild Bill Hickok, he's leftist, and it wasn't true. There was a story about his fight with the so-called McCandless gang. Now, there was an incident in which there was a bit of a gun battle and two men died and Hickok survived. But by the time that got, you know, went through several iterations, the story along the frontier was that he had, with just his bare hands and a knife, had single-handedly killed all ten members of the McCandless gang. So, fake news is nothing new.
Right. And this is just the sort of a paragon example of what it is. And obviously, yeah, one can imagine how a given paper would sell out if it had a headline brandishing the huge news, such as Wild Bill having been killed. You write at one point, Wild Bill became bigger than any of the legendary figures that had come before him in the mind of a gullible and impressionable public. And later you say, a public eager for tales of the mysterious and fabulous American West.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important for us to understand now what that American public was sort of thinking and feeling about this vast expanse known as the Old West, and how a figure like Wild Bill Hickok would, in a sense, play perfectly into that mindset.
Well, he was a distinctive-looking man, and he did go on a lot of adventures in which he was by himself, perhaps as a scout for the U.S. Army, as a deputy U.S. marshal. He was a federal marshal who patrolled vast expanses of territory and chasing down Army deserters and stolen horses and things like that. And back into the East, where most of the reading public was, and that's the only way at that time that people got information was through reading. There were, you know, obviously way before there was television or radio. The West was in some ways a mysterious, thrilling and mysterious place. They didn't know a lot about it. In fact, up until the Civil War, once the area west of the Missouri River was, you know, a lot of times it was dubbed as the Great American Desert. That's what the way people viewed it. A lot of people just didn't know what was between the East Coast and out way out in the Pacific Coast, and then you had this mythical figure like Wild Bill Hickok, who was on a daily basis was in that area, was exploring it, was having these hair-raising adventures and close scrapes and daring escapes as a Union spy, there's a story there where he was discovered by himself. Six Indians attacked him, and he managed to fight them off. One was wounded, four were killed, one escaped. And when that story got around, of course, by the time it got back to the East Coast, he'd fought off a whole tribe of Indians. So there was a lot of room for exaggerations, because people were reading about a vast, to them, unknown area of America that had a lot of mystery and a lot of potential for thrilling adventures.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin about his remarkable new book called Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. One of the things I appreciate, Mr. Clavin, about your book is that, in a sense, you don't pretend to know more than is possible to know about the details of Wild Bill Hickok's life. And at the same time, it's not that you avoid some of these wild stories that almost certainly are not true, because those very stories are kind of part of the truth of who he was and what he represented. That being said, take us inside the challenge that you confronted in trying to figure out where is the actual truth. What are the stories about Wild Bill Hickok that we can believe, and what are the others that we should sort of set off to the side and view in a different way as fiction fabricated in the moment for whatever reason? How does one, so many years later, come to grips with a challenge like that?
Well, I do, in the book, sort of bring the reader in a little bit from time to time, because there's kind of like three categories of material for the book Wild Bill. One is the material that I could corroborate, meaning that I could find reliable sources that some of which were, you know, Hickok's letters himself. He was a letter writer, thank goodness, to family members, to the woman who eventually became his wife, to others. He wrote letters to the editor of newspapers. And there's also reporting that went on at the time, some of which was indeed accurate. Not everything was embellished or exaggerated. Then there's the material that I couldn't use, you know, the outright fabrications, the dime store novels, the comic book-like adventures that he had, in which, you know, the same tale is told over and over again, that just this wasn't true the first time, but just kept getting repeated and exaggerated and getting bigger over time. And then I let the reader know that there are some times when, you know, something falls in the middle. Like, there's a good chance to believe that this is true. There are some doubts about it, and there's a couple of times I let the readers know, I can't tell you this absolutely for certain, especially, you know, one example is his activities as a spy for the Union during the Civil War. You know, we know some of his adventures that took place, but some of them, you know, he would talk about later after the war. Were they true or not? We don't know for sure. After all, he was a spy. It wasn't like what he was doing behind enemy lines was being broadcast at the time he was doing it. And I think probably, certainly one of the most vivid examples of trying to separate the truth from fiction has to do with Calamity Jane. Now, you know, popular culture would have it that Calamity Jane and Wild Bill Hickok were lovers. There was a great romance between them. And first of all, that was not true. Calamity Jane, yes, was a real figure and a fascinating figure, and I write about her and all her idiosyncratic glory in the book Wild Bill. But Hickok really couldn't stand Calamity Jane. She was not the girl for him. She told anybody who would listen, of course, that Hickok was infatuated with her, and that, you know, sort of like got solidified in the movie The Plainsman back in the 1930s with Gary Cooper playing Wild Bill and Gene Autry as Calamity Jane. And we also had the movie Doris Day as Calamity Jane. But in fact, that does a disservice to a woman named Agnes Lake, who was actually the love of Hickok's life. She was the only woman that he was truly in love with, and that he ended up marrying. And who knows who she is? You know, if you ask 10 people who's Wild Bill Hickok, they would give some kind of answer: a gunfighter, a scout, a lawman, whatever. You asked who is Agnes Lake, there'd be a total blank. And yet she's a remarkable. She was the only female circus owner in the United States. I mean, she was the rival of Barnum and Bailey and the Ringling Brothers. Her circus had hippos, had elephants, and, you know, pretty spectacular. That was very well known and toured the country. That was the woman, this very independent, lovely businesswoman, who Hickok fell in love with, and she fell in love with him, and they eventually got married. So I think being able to tell their story is one of the satisfactions of finding out the true story of Wild Bill Hickok.
Hmm. And we should mention that other colorful figures of the era are also woven into this narrative, figures like Buffalo Bill and Kit Carson and General Custer and so on.
Frank and Jesse James, yeah.
Right, would figure at various points in the colorful life and career of Wild Bill Hickok. One thing that is interesting to me, very early in the book, you say that the real story is at least as exciting and fascinating, if not more so, than the legends that have been attributed to Wild Bill Hickok. That seems like a fascinating and maybe unexpected phenomenon, that part of the whole point of fabricating legends is to fabricate something that's even more incredible than what there actually is. But I think you're really pointing to something important here when you say that actually, in a sense, one shouldn't waste one's time with the fabricated legend because the real story is actually even more riveting.
Yeah, and I first got that strong sense when I was working on my book Dodge City, which came out a couple of years ago, and it's the story of Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and the city that was known at the time as the wickedest town in the American West. And Dodge City was an example of all kinds of fabrications, and certainly it's true of Wyatt Earp's life. There have been all kinds of exaggerations and embellishments. To his dying day, he kept trying to set the record straight and never quite was successful. Things just started to spring up around him and that he had no control over about his life. And that's a reason why I, after Dodge City was over, I started work on the story of James Butler Hickok, which was his real name, James Butler Hickok, not Bill at all, because it was the same thing. As I found out about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, the adventures they had, the friendship between them, the gunfights they were in, their work as deputy marshal, deputy sheriffs, sheriff of Ford County, what you can find out is actually true, was really quite fascinating and quite exciting, and you could sort of read it guilt-free because you were enjoying it, but you weren't enjoying it wondering, this can't be true. You were enjoying it with the knowledge that, this had been carefully researched and it is true. And that became the same, modus operandi for doing the story of Wild Bill Hickok, that you could, if you get past the exaggerations and the outright fictions, there's still great stories there that he did. And that makes him, I think, even a more fascinating character, because here's a man that really did live some of these adventures, and for the most part, until the very end, of course, he survived them. And only his legend grew, but it for a good reason, because the legend was based on a lot of really true adventures.
Mm. Let's touch on a couple of factors in his life and persona that are not always talked about or not always explored as extensively as you do so in your book. He was the son of an ardent abolitionist, and he himself was also a fervent abolitionist. And I want you to just say a word about how you think this shaped the man he became and what he ended up representing.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, yes, his father was very anti-slavery, and their farm in Illinois, as James Butler Hickok was growing up, was a way station on the Underground Railroad. His father actually smuggled escaped and runaway slaves farther north to safety. And I think one of the things that young Hickok got out of that was a sense of fighting injustice and fighting, giving people fair play, treating people the way he would like to be treated. All through the rest of his life, he would always side with the underdog, and he hated bullies and people who beat up other people, which was certainly the case with slaves when they would be abused terribly, and he knew about that. He learned that from a very early age from talking to them when they were waiting to be transferred to the next place, what some of their experiences were like, and it really did affect his mindset about fairness and injustice for the rest of his life.
He was a spy in the Union Army, and you tell us that he was a productive spy. That, in other words, the what a spy had to do behind enemy lines, in a sense, really tied into some of his most impressive innate gifts and skills.
Yeah, he was a successful spy in the sense that, first of all, he survived, and he was behind enemy lines, often dressed as a Confederate sergeant or an officer, which, upon discovery, would have meant automatic execution. And he did manage from time to time to emerge from behind enemy lines to supply the Union officers with valuable information on troop strength and troop positioning There's a couple of times that he would become the part of the inner circle of one of the commanding officers, like a Confederate general in Missouri, something like that, and listening to the general talking to his senior officers and about what their strategy is and what they're planning to do and things like that, and then managing to sneak out and get this information across the Union lines to the people who needed to know about it. And he had some very close scrapes. You know, this is one story in the book that he was discovered and put into a cabin with the expectation that they would be taken out at dawn and shot. And he managed to escape, just barely escape, and like a day and a half later find his way to the Union lines. So that is kind of exciting. But I do tell the reader there's some things we don't know about his activities. And I can only tell you what I was able to corroborate, and there's things that have been said about it. I can't guarantee it's true.
Hmm. He kills his first man in 1861 and kills many, many men after that, of course. And you tell us plenty about those sorts of exploits. What can you tell us about his skill with a gun? And in particular, maybe just say a word about how there are actually some rather detailed accounts of what he was like with a gun and what made him so formidable.
Yeah, he had discovered as a kid that he had a talent for shooting. First, it was used for hunting to provide the game for the family dinner table, which was very helpful. But he really enjoyed it. And I don't mean in a sadistic way, but he did not set out to kill anybody. That wasn't why he became proficient with guns, but just that he knew that guns on the American frontier were a way of protection. And if you're going to protect yourself with a gun, why not be the best you can with it? So he taught himself not only how to shoot with amazing accuracy, but to do so with both hands. So he had, that's why he always wore the two Colts six shooters with the handles out, because he could shoot just as well with the right hand as he could with the left. And so and he always was the last one to engage in a fight. By that I mean he was never an aggressor. He didn't want to initiate any kind of gunfight. But as the book details, there were times in his life where people made it impossible for him to have any other option. And if he did have to resort to, if he drew his gun, then he did. He shot to kill. You know, he was going to be the fastest and he was going to be the most accurate. And numerous times that saved his life.
I was struck by how detailed some of your descriptions are, not yours specifically, but I mean the detailed accounts that you quote of his appearance, of his
yes.
physical appearance, and how he often stood out rather spectacularly, even before he'd drawn his gun, just in his appearance, the way he carried himself. And at one point, as you are describing this, you even say that there were ways in which there were actually slightly feminine qualities about his appearance, particularly in terms of how he sort of took care of himself. Could you just say a word about this? I found this absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of accounts of people describing his appearance, and one of the things that many of them point out is that he bathed every day. Now, to us, this is not remarkable, but on the American frontier in the 1860s, for example, people went for weeks without bathing, you know, if not longer, and yet he bathed every day, whether it was jumping into a stream or a town bathhouse. He really took care of himself, how he looked. He had the long, flowing brown hair down and sometimes past his shoulders. He always wore a black sombrero, yellow moccasins, buckskin outfit. So sometimes when he was in town gambling, he'd wear pinstripe pants and a Prince Albert frock with a vest. He was also 6'1", and he had this very slim waist, and some people would refer to his slim waist as almost like a feminine quality. He was not a hard-featured man. He had sort of like a soft-featured face. So there were a couple of descriptions of him that would point to, that would say something like an almost feminine quality. And I don't think that they meant that as anything critical of him at all or questioning his manliness. It's just that I think that they were surprised when they actually encountered Wild Bill Hickok, the famed gunfighter and shootist, and what a term they used back then, man-killer, that they were not encountering somebody who looked like a real tough guy. He was an imposing figure in a lot of ways, but he also had, he had this approachable side to him, and he was always also described too as having a friendly face. So he wasn't this hardened criminal-looking kind of guy.
Mm. And you talk about how the as his legend grew, this became something of a burden, and he actually in some ways went out of his way to live up to the legend that was building up. And then, of course, some kind of malady begins to affect his eyesight, which in a sense was the beginning of the end. And we, unfortunately, all these years later, have no idea exactly what was going wrong with his eyesight. But that was the worst possible news for somebody in the business in which he was engaged. But in the last couple minutes, I want you to address something you say. When you say Hickok was both the prototype and the first victim of progress on the American frontier, what do you mean by those intriguing words?
Well, he became the prototype of the two-fisted, two-gun lawman on the American frontier, where the justice system was very rough, was still being developed. You know, people were trying to figure out doing jury trials and having judges and things like that. And so, you know, when Hickok especially was the Marshal of Abilene, he basically had, you know, he went with his fists and the guns, he tamed that town. And so so he was that prototype. He was the advance guard, let's say, of trying to bring justice and law and order to the frontier. But then when it took hold, he did not really adapt. It started to get past him. Towns started to hire marshals who were peace officers as opposed to lawmen. And Hickok didn't get a job really after Abilene because he was seen as an old-fashioned kind of frontier lawman. And the towns wanted to embrace the new kind of lawman that put people in jail and found ways other than guns to resolve disputes. So it's kind of like that, plus what you mentioned about his fading eyesight. There's kind of a tragic aspect to Wild Bill Hickok, that he was a celebrity and he was a person who earned and deserved a lot of recognition. But he also was one that the West started to pass him by. And he died at only 39, and yet that was a full life in the sense of all the adventures he had, but also because it didn't seem like the rest of his life, especially with his failing eyesight, was going to be all that enjoyable. So and certainly would be more dangerous.
The book again, Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter, published by St. Martin's Press, the author Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, you've done it again. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about yet another fascinating book from your pen, and best wishes.
Thank you. It's been a privilege for me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I'm really excited about the next few minutes here on WGTD's Morning Show. First of all, it's always a special pleasure to speak to someone who is a familiar name and voice for National Public Radio listeners. And on this occasion, it is best-selling author Eric Weiner, who has done a fair amount of work for National Public Radio, as well as the New York Times, a highly regarded writer and author of the bestseller, The Geography of Bliss. His new book has certainly generated a great deal of comment and discussion, a book called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. In it, Eric Weiner explores some various religions of the world, not as a scholar, but at least to some extent as someone genuinely seeking spiritual direction for his own life. He's made some intriguing choices in terms of what religions or spiritual practices he sought out and not only studied but sought to experience firsthand, and has written about it in this fascinating new book. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Eric Weiner about his book, which is published by 12, again, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric Weiner, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's good to be here, Greg.
I appreciate so much that in the book's introduction, not only do you kind of tell the story of your health scare that is, to some extent sort of pushed all of this in motion, but you really take some time to help us understand what your own spirituality was like before all of this began. I mean, your own sort of spiritual state, and you are careful not to rely on any tired labels because none of them seem to fit exactly who you are.
Right.
And the implication is that maybe those labels are ill-fitting to a whole lot of people. Talk a moment about what I'm referring to.
Yeah, sure. No, I absolutely agree that when it comes to, you know, discussing or even thinking about religion and spirituality in this country, I think we actually do a pretty poor job. And one reason, as you suggest there, is that we don't have the right words, the right labels to fit. You know, if you say you're religious, well, you know, what does that mean? I think certain images come to mind. But then if you're not, you know, a sort of traditionally religious person, what are you? Are you an atheist? Actually, a very small percentage of Americans, I think about 4%, consider themselves atheist. I suspect that, in fact, I know with some certainty that there is a very large group in between, the sort of true believers and the hardcore atheists on the opposite ends of the spectrum. Most of us, including myself, are somewhere in the middle. You know, we are spiritual, or we have these spiritual yearnings. Maybe we don't go to church or synagogue or a mosque on a regular basis, but that's not the only measure of religiosity. And we are basically confused, I think it's fair to say. Hopeful, but confused. And that's sort of where I decided I was. I decided I was a confusionist, sort of making up a word there, in the sense that I consider myself a very rational person. I think science is a very great thing and has made our world a lot better. But ultimately, I don't think science does a very good job of helping us grapple with those three big questions. Where do we come from? What happens when we die? And what should we do in the meantime? How should we lead our lives? How should we lead meaningful lives? And, you know, I think religion, for all its faults, and it has plenty, don't get me wrong, there is much wisdom in the pages and the rituals and really the philosophy of religion. And that's how I approach this journey, looking at religion as a kind of applied philosophy. Ideas, teachings that can help us get through the day a little bit happier and a little bit wiser than we thought possible.
If we could just circle back to the matter of terminology for a moment, one of the most interesting things I thought was when you dealt with the term agnostic. Because in terms of what you just described, and as someone who is confused, by your own words, you're someone confused and uncertain in terms of the existence of God or what the role of all this should be in one's life. Some people would say, well, then that's what you're an agnostic, and you have some problems with the term agnostic, and I thought that was intriguing.
I do. You know, it's been said that agnostics are atheists without the conviction, you know, and I think there might be some truth to that. There's a kind of passivity, I think, to the term and the concept of being an agnostic, which means literally one without knowledge, because it fails to take into account that you can be an agnostic who is very active, actually. You can be an agnostic that's not sitting around waiting for evidence of God's existence or the existence of something beyond our material world. You could be actively seeking answers, pursuing all kinds of spiritual activities, whether it's meditation or prayer or whatever. I guess what bothers me about the term is that it's sort of just a catch-all category for people who aren't true believers or hardcore atheists. And it doesn't do a very good job, I think, of describing this whole range of people. Some who might be very passive and say, well, I'm just going to wait for some sign, and until that time I'm doing nothing. To also people, I think, like myself, who are very active, who are reading an awful lot from all the spiritual traditions, and who are going out and doing things.
Right. In other words, the implication of the term agnostic, or the way we tend to think of it, is as someone who's not sure and also doesn't care. I mean, the whole matter is not important to them. And you would describe yourself as someone who really has felt some hunger, some yearning in this regard. Of course, what ultimately prompts you to do some seeking in a much more, shall we say, aggressive fashion, is what we might call sort of a brush with death. That might be overstating it just a little bit, although it was obviously a very, very important experience for you. Tell our listeners about that, and maybe ahead of that, a little bit about your great aversion to hospitals, which you talk about right at the top of the introduction.
Well, I mean, of course, nobody likes hospitals, but I like them even less than most because my father was a doctor. He was an oncologist, and you know, I learned at a very young age that people died and that they tended to die in hospitals. And so, you know, my 8-year-old brain concluded that if I just avoided hospitals, I would never die. You know, and it was airtight logic for an 8-year-old. And so I really avoid them at all costs. But a few years ago, it was an August evening, I developed these sharp shooting abdominal pains, and it was unlike anything I had experienced. You know, it wasn't just indigestion. Something was clearly wrong. And finally, reluctantly, with my wife's prodding, I agreed to go to the emergency room. And, you know, they give you that big paper towel to wear, and they call it a robe, but really it's a paper towel, and you're lying in this cold examination room, and the doctors have done all these CT scans, and they come back and announce, and I'm quoting here, that there's something funky on my CT scan, and they need to call in a specialist. So, you know, now I'm basically panicking, concerned that something truly is wrong. And I'm lying there with my own thoughts and my fear. And this nurse walks in, and she must have, you know, picked up on my fear because it was hard to miss. You know, I was reeking of fear. And she leans down to draw blood or something, and she whispers in my ear these words I'll never forget. Have you found your God yet? That's what she said. And at first I was like, whoa, have you seen my scan? What do you know? It was a startling question, to put it mildly.
And it was interesting, you said it wasn't, have you found God or the God or a God, but your God. Have you found your God? You were struck by the specific words she chose for that intriguing question.
Yeah. Think about it. Have you found your God? It sort of implies, you know, that there's just one out there waiting for me, almost like a sort of romantic courtship. You know, have you found your soulmate? You know, have you found that special person in your life? And I realized it was a very interesting choice of words and very indicative, I think, of the time we live in, where we are free, probably freer than any people ever in human history, to choose our religion or spiritual path. If you think about it, one out of three Americans will change their religious affiliation over the course of their lifetime, which is a remarkable statistic. We're sort of hopping around, shopping, if you want to put it that way, for a spiritual path. And we have all these choices available to us, which is a wonderful thing, but also potentially dangerous.
You write about how you had, and we've already talked about how you were, in some respects, already hungry to know more and had done a fair amount of reading. But you kind of say something really interesting about how, for some people, and you would count yourself among them, that some people almost seem to read about spirituality as a way of sort of substituting for the real thing, or in a sense using those books as kind of a surrogate for the actual experience.
Yeah, and I'm definitely one of those people because I'm more comfortable inside my head. You know, that's where I spend most of my time. And I realized that I was just this sort of promiscuous underliner of books and consumer of books and dog-earer of books. And I would sort of satisfy my spiritual yearnings that way. I would read the Dalai Lama, Joseph Campbell, Houston Smith, Paul Tillich, all these great theologians, and sort of nod my head, underline the passage, and then put the book down and go back to my ordinary everyday life. And, you know, it's sort of, I mean, Greg, it's sort of the difference between reading volumes about wine, never having any, or just sitting down and having a particularly nice glass of Pinot Noir, you know.
I was thinking, the parallel that came to my mind was looking at certain kinds of cookbooks with gorgeous full-color photographs and never making a recipe. and some
never
cookbook.
Never eating a gourmet meal either, yeah. So, you know, the Sufis say that the taste is the thing, you know. And there, so that is the thing. Is it's one thing to read about these experiences, and it's certainly interesting intellectually. It is another thing to have the experiences, and especially when it comes to quote-unquote mystical experiences. It's been said there's no such thing as a mystical experience in the abstract. So, and I think there is truth to that. So I recognized early on in this journey that I needed to, well, let me be clear, reading is fine. And I, if you look at the bibliography in the book, you'll see I read, you know, easily more than 100 books. But reading is not enough.
So ultimately, you decided to embark on a concerted spiritual journey. And you had literally hundreds of different religions from which to choose. In fact, you make a really interesting observation at one point that the fact that there is this proliferation of various kinds of faith and spiritual practices, you say, creates the illusion that it is easier than ever to know God. And in fact, at least at the moment when you began all this, you felt that emphatically not to be the case. So tell us how you ended up choosing the 8 specific religious or spiritual practices that you ultimately explored. What did you have to discard, and for what reason were all of these other possibilities discarded in favor of these particular 8?
Well, you're right. It was not an easy sort of winnowing down process, because in fact there are some 9,900 religions in the world, which is an incredible number. And I had to go through the task of trying to bring it down to something manageable. Well, I eliminated religions that, like Zoroastrianism, very old and fascinating faith, but one that does not accept converts, right? So they wouldn't accept me as a convert, so I would scratch those off. Some struck me as overly narrow, like Hungarian folk religion. I'm not Hungarian, I'm not particularly folksy, so I scratched that one off the list. Others, which I know have actually fair following in this country, such as Unitarian Universalists, struck me as overly broad, that it was there was no core belief system there, and believing in everything struck me somewhat as like believing in nothing, so I scratched that off the list. And ultimately, I came up with 8 religions that were sort of a cross-section of the whole panoply of religions out there, some monotheistic, like Christianity, Judaism, Islam, some polytheistic, like Wicca, or what's called neo-paganism, or more colloquially, witchcraft, which is a part of that, a subset of that. And even some, you know, I call them atheistic religions, which is essentially what they are. Buddhism and Taoism are religions in every sense of the word, except they don't believe in a god or a supreme being. So, and some of these religions were very mainstream. Franciscan Catholics were on the list, but ones like witchcraft and a few others were definitely on the fringes.
I can tell from the way you wrote the introduction that to a great extent, this was a very sincere undertaking for you. And yet one of the things I wonder is what would have happened? I mean, if this, in fact, were a 100% sincere spiritual pursuit, what would have happened along the way, if, for instance, the first or second thing you explored had, in effect, answered your hunger, solved your questions, and made any further search, in a sense, a moot point?
It would have been a shorter book.
That's for sure.
Basically.
Right.
But, you know, not to overstretch the metaphor of dating, but that's essentially what I was doing, sort of spiritual version of speed dating, you know.
Flirtation is in the subtitle.
Yes, and that's what I was doing. But flirtation serves a very important role, you know. It allows us to sort of test drive relationships without committing to them, and that's essentially what I was doing. And, you know, I wasn't doing it in a sort of half-hearted way. I was very serious in the reading and the practice that I did for each faith, but I was trying to sort of have this sort of spiritual discernment or spiritual intelligence, like trying to figure out, is this does this appeal to me? Is this the right way? And it's very tricky because choosing a religion, you know, let's face it, it is fundamentally different from choosing your breakfast cereal or a new car. You know, it's not all rational. And unlike with, say, a car, you know, we know we're looking for a certain, you know, mileage and certain features. With a religion, we don't really know what we're looking for until we find it. So it's a different kind of seeking, if you know what I mean.
Right. One thing you point out is that, of course, on the one hand, you have religious fundamentalists who ardently believe that their religion is the only worthwhile religion, and their regard for people of other religious faiths can range from utter disinterest to utter disdain. And on the other end of the extreme are those who believe that all of these religions are exactly the same. One is not any better than the other. And it's interesting how, in a sense, you aren't particularly a fan of that perspective either.
Which one? The latter?
The latter.
Yeah, because I don't think they are all the same. You know, I think we tend to sort of in a knee-jerk way, and ironically, now that I think about it, both in sort of, you know, hardcore atheists and certain religious people would also say, oh, they're all roads lead to the same destination. All religions are at their core the same. Maybe at their very core, but that's not the way we live our world. We don't normally live in the core. So there are differences, and there are huge differences. And, you know, would you say that, you know, all roads lead to the same destination? I'm sure there in Milwaukee, you get on one road and, you know, you're in, I don't know the geography.
I know what you're saying.
you're in Chicago and another one and you're in Iowa. You know, the path matters. And I think we actually do religions a disservice by glossing them over and say, well, they're all the same.
There is a disdain. Yeah, there's an implied sort of gentle disdain when one says something like that. You might not even.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, when you say they're all the same, in a sense, you're saying none of them deeply matter, or I mean, it's actually a way to dismiss them all, in a sense.
Yes, and I know atheists like Christopher Hitchens, who I admire as a great intellect, he has said that. He has said, you know, if you want to go and try different religions or even mix them up, go ahead. It's all mush. You're starting with mush, and you mix up mush, and you get more mush at the end. And that is his take on this sort of, you know, the spiritual explorations that people embark on, that basically it doesn't matter. It's all mush. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have people who are very earnest, very politically correct, to be honest, who would say, well, all religions are equally true. They're equally good. I think they may have the potential to be so, but in practice, that's not always the case.
Right.
There's a reason why some religions appeal to people more than others. Some are more, to use the vernacular, user-friendly than others. There are differences, and those differences are fascinating, I think.
Really quick, we're almost out of time. As a person of religious faith myself, I honestly picked up your book with great nervousness. And I have to say it was not as difficult a thing for me to read as I feared it might be. I mean, I honestly didn't know if I was going to be sort of offended.
Does that mean you liked it?
in many ways, yes. And I just wonder, as you wrote the book, how conscious were you of the possibility of a religious person holding this book in their hands and reading it? Were you conscious of the feelings of religious people as you wrote it?
That's a really good question, Greg. I am fully aware that when I sat down to write this book, I was going to offend some people, because it is absolutely impossible to write about religion in this country without offending someone. But I try to be as absolutely honest as possible. And I do use humor in the book. You probably picked up on that. But I try to use the humor in the service of trying to uncover some truths. And I think that it is possible to write a book where a religious person like yourself finds something in it, and someone who is, you know, this vast, confused, agnostic territory also finds something in it. I've heard, to be honest, from a few people like yourself who have said that, as a religious Christian. They picked up the book and wanting to hate it, and they ended up not hating it as much as they had thought. And I'll take that as a compliment.
The book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. It's published by 12. Eric Weiner, thank you so much. I enjoyed this. And
it's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
And that wraps up the Friday Morning Show. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission.